The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and then from the Harvard Women's Health Letter. And the first one comes from the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2023. And it's entitled, For Mellow Movement That Helps Your Heart, Try Tai Chi. Need a workout that's engaging but won't leave you feeling tired and sweaty? Tai Chi may be just the ticket. Most people recognize that exercise is one of the best ways to boost cardiovascular health. But what if traditional exercise seems either too challenging or otherwise inaccessible, or maybe even boring? Or perhaps you're recovering from a heart attack or other medical problem and need to ease back into activity. If so, Tai Chi might be worth a try. Tai Chi is a gentle, adaptable practice that features flowing movements combined with breathing and cognitive focus, says Dr. Peter Wayne, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Medical Editor of the Harvard Special Health Report. An introduction to Tai Chi. The cardiovascular benefits likely stem from a combination of physical and mental aspects of this ancient Chinese practice. A Tai Chi session doesn't aim to dramatically raise your heart rate or build bulky muscles, but the slow, deliberate movements still help to tone your muscles. If you move more quickly from one position to the next and sink deeper into the postures, Tai Chi can even provide a moderate aerobic workout. Conversely, you can dial down the intensity and even do certain movements while seated in a chair. Unlike yoga, Tai Chi doesn't require you to fully extend or stretch your joints, so it's fine for people who are not so flexible. Like yoga, Tai Chi is a mind-body practice that requires focused attention as you move through a series of choreographed moves. Many have descriptive names that evoke scenes from nature, like wave hands like clouds, or the white crane spreads its wings. Concentrating on that imagery along with your breathing and movements counteracts what Asian meditative traditions call monkey mind, the distracting mental chatter that often intrudes when people do traditional meditation. In this way, Tai Chi can foster relaxation and ease stress. Tai Chi also teaches you to pay close attention to your posture, your breathing, and your heart rate. This increased body awareness can help prevent injury and overexertion, says Dr. Wayne. An article published online July 3, 2023 by Cardiology and Review considered the heart-related benefits of Tai Chi. Many studies have documented improvements in blood pressure after just 8 to 12 weeks of practicing Tai Chi, including among older sedentary adults and heart attack survivors. There's also good evidence that Tai Chi can be an effective alternative for people who don't want to do traditional cardiac rehabilitation. A structural program of exercise and education for people recovering from heart-related problems. In addition, Tai Chi has proved helpful for people with heart failure, who tend to be tired and weak as a result of the heart's diminished pumping ability. The authors also point out that Tai Chi can be a gateway to other types of physical activity because the practice may improve balance, reduce the risk of falls, and even help to ease low back pain, a common reason for avoiding exercise. More fundamentally, the fitness gains and self-awareness from Tai Chi training can give people the confidence to engage in other physical and social activities that can enhance health, says Dr. Wayne. Finally, here's the last article from the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2023. and it's called Genetic Profiling for Heart Disease, an update. As the leading cause of premature death in this country, cardiovascular disease is to blame for more than $150 billion in lost productivity each year. Thanks to decades of research, we know a great deal about what predisposes people to coronary artery disease, the most prevalent form of heart disease and the root cause of most heart attacks. Doctors still can't predict heart attacks very accurately. Some people who appear prone to heart attacks never have one, while others succumb to heart disease despite having no obvious risks. Can genetic profiling help? Perhaps, according to a 2022 scientific statement from the American Heart Association that looked at the promise and challenge of such testing. Using a small sample of blood or saliva, these tests analyze millions of common variants in your DNA to create what's known as a polygenic risk score. You can have 0, 1, or 2 copies of any gene variant, each of which may raise or lower your risk of coronary artery disease. 10 years ago, there were just 20 or 30 known variants that affected coronary artery disease, but today there are more than 3 million, says Dr. Nicholas Marston, a preventive cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Scientists discover variants by comparing the genetic codes of people without coronary artery disease to those of people with the disease. Many of these variants occur in genes known to affect heart disease, like those related to cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood clotting. Others aren't well understood and may provide targets for future research, potentially fueling new drug discovery efforts, he adds. A polygenic risk score reflects the overall impact of all the variants together and is expressed as a percentile. But a high score like the 95th percentile doesn't mean you have a 95% chance for developing the disease. It means that among 100 people, your score is higher than 95 people and the same or lower than 5. So far, research using polygenic risk scores for coronary artery disease suggests they may offer modest improvements for predicting risk in people who are middle-aged or younger. In some cases, the score can help doctors decide whether to be more or less aggressive in prescribing cholesterol-lowering medications like statins, says Dr. Marston. For example, a 35-year-old man with a father who died of a heart attack at age 45 may wonder what he can do to escape the fate, especially if his cholesterol numbers look fine. Standard risk calculators to guide statin treatment don't apply to people under 40, so a polygenic risk score can help the doctor decide if and when the man should start a statin. In addition to statins, more powerful cholesterol-lowering drugs like alirocumab or Praluent or evolocumab or Repatha are available. These drugs are expensive and insurance doesn't always cover them, so it doesn't make sense to give them to everyone. A polygenic risk score may help to identify which heart attack survivors would benefit the most from these medications. Currently, people can find their scores by participating in a research study like the Electronic Medical Records and Genomics Network. That's called eMERGE. Scientists at some hospitals at Harvard and 9 other institutions around the country are investigating the genetic risk of several heart-related conditions, as well as cancer and other diseases. A handful of direct-to-consumer companies also provide cardiovascular-based scores for $250. Dr. Marston has recommended the test for several of his patients who must pay out of pocket since insurance doesn't cover the tests. Another limitation is that the scores are based mainly on people with European ancestry, which means the scores may not be reliable for people of different ethnicities. But efforts to expand the diversity of the data are underway. For older people, polygenic risk scores for heart disease just aren't very helpful. By the time you're 70, decades of lifestyle habits have shaped your risk, and genetic factors are less relevant. Ultimately, you want the results to be actionable. We won't see a big uptake for using polygenic risk scores until they demonstrate a role in medical decision making, says Dr. Marston. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Women's Health Watch, and the lead article is entitled, this is the October 2023 issue, the lead article is entitled, Mastering Memory Maintenance. You know something important to you when you can't seem to get it out of your mind. For many of us, as we age, staying sharp seems to be that thing, a priority that becomes increasingly pressing as we hear frightening projections that dementia will affect 9 million Americans aged 65 and older by 2030, and 12 million by 2040. There's more focus on this now because medical science has done a relatively good job of treating heart disease and cancer, but has made fewer strides in addressing memory disorders like dementia, says Dr. Andrew Budson, a lecturer in neurology at Harvard Medical School. I think more people are worried about this than ever. But concern need not feed a sense of helplessness. Indeed, research is revealing we may possess more power against brain decline than once believed. A large new study zeroes in on the potent influence a healthy lifestyle exerts on memory maintenance, even in older adults with a genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease. Just because you have a family history of a medical condition or a neurocognitive disorder like dementia doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be stricken with it, says Lydia Cho, a neuropsychologist at Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital. Our genetics don't completely define our physical and neurocognitive health. We have a choice of how to improve our bodies and minds to live the healthiest life we can. The new study, published online January 25, 2023, by the British Medical Journal, involved more than 29,000 people in China without dementia, whose average age was 72. Participants initially underwent cognitive testing, as well as genetic testing, a variant of the APOE gene called APOE4, which is known to raise the risk for Alzheimer's. Participants also reported how stringently they stuck to 6 good lifestyle habits: eating a healthy diet, exercising regularly, not smoking, not drinking alcohol, being socially active, and engaging in brain-challenging activities. Over the next 10 years, participants periodically reported their lifestyle habits and had additional cognitive tests. By the study's end, people who stuck with at least 4 healthy habits exhibited significantly lower memory decline than those who didn't practice any healthy habits. This was true even among participants with the Alzheimer's-related gene. Dr. Budson wasn't surprised by the findings, noting that earlier studies reported similar results. But I'm thrilled that additional evidence has shown that by making these healthy lifestyle changes, people really are able to reduce their risk of developing dementia. I think the study's message is clear. Your fate, to a large extent, is in your own hands. Now we're going to continue this article. Let's dissect the 6 lifestyle habits that appear to stem memory decline, and why practicing each is important to our brain health. The first is eat a healthy diet. Doing so reduces the risk of clots and other blood vessel problems in the brain, thereby cutting the risk of stroke, the second leading cause of memory problems. What's bad for the brain? One important example is eating simple sugars and carbohydrates in processed foods, which cause glucose and insulin spikes that can damage brain cells. Also, we should exercise regularly. Defined in the study as 150 minutes of moderate or 75 minutes of vigorous activity every week. Consistent exercise boosts brain health through two pathways, reducing the risk of stroke and generating growth factors that help to spawn new brain cells. Plus, there are more new brain cells produced in a structure called the hippocampus, which is critical for learning memory than in any other part of the brain, Dr. Budson says. Number three is don't smoke. By not smoking, you're doing two very important things. You're reducing the risk of stroke and increasing the oxygen-carrying capacity of your red blood cells, Dr. Budson says. Number four is limit drinking. There's no evidence that having a single alcoholic beverage a day causes permanent damage to the brain, but there's increasing evidence that having more than one drink per day can, Dr. Budson says. We all should be aware that even with a single drink, our memory performance will not be as good as if we abstained. Number five is stay socially active. This can mean regularly visiting friends or relatives, attending parties, participating in meetings, traveling, and chatting online. Scientists don't fully understand why this tactic keeps brains healthier. I think it's because social interaction activates very large areas of the brain, Dr. Budson says. It's important to keep your mind active, and social interactions are truly one of the best ways to do that. Finally, you need to challenge your brain. This could include both fun pursuits and more serious ones, like reading, writing, playing chess and card games, taking a course, learning a new language, and the like. Crossword puzzles are especially good because they force people to think about concepts and the relation between words and ideas in new, flexible, creative ways. Now we're going to continue in the Harvard Women's Health Watch in the October 2023 issue, and we're going to go over a section called Ask the Doctors with Dr. Tony Golan and Dr. Hope Ricciotti. The question is, why are my ankles swollen? Over the last few months, I've noticed my ankles get really swollen by the end of the day. Why could this be happening? The answer is, you're describing edema, which happens twice as often in women as men. It happens when fluid backs up in the small blood vessels of the low legs, ankles, or feet, and pools in surrounding tissues. Often edema develops when you sit or stand in one place for a long time, but it can also be a sign of more serious problems. The most common cause is chronic venous insufficiency, which also causes varicose veins. But edema can also be caused by more serious conditions like deep vein thrombosis, which is blood clots in the leg veins, or impaired heart, liver, or kidney function. Less commonly, lymphedema, a blockage in lymph channels, is the underlying reason for the leg swelling. Besides being a woman, other risk factors for developing edema include pregnancy, obesity, hormonal changes, certain medications, and age. If you're prone to edema, prolonged sitting or standing in one place will tend to make it worse. But persistent edema isn't something you should ignore. See your doctor to determine its cause. In the meantime, you can help ease ankle swelling by staying physically active and elevating your legs several times a day. Decreasing salt intake can also help. Now here's a second question for the doctors. For the past week, I've been dealing with vaginal itching, burning, and discharge. What might be causing these symptoms? Vaginitis, or inflammation of the lining inside the vagina, sounds like the culprit. But vaginitis, which can also include vaginal odor and soreness inside and around the vagina and vulva, is an umbrella term encompassing several distinct conditions that inflame or infect the vagina, all with different causes and treatments. These include bacterial vaginosis, when natural bacterial levels are out of balance, yeast infection, a fungal infection involving an overgrowth of yeast, sexually transmitted infections like chlamydia, gonorrhea, and trichomoniasis, and atrophic vaginitis, which is common among women in the menopause transition and beyond due to drier, more delicate vaginal tissue. See your primary care clinician or gynecologist to get to the root of your symptoms. Treatments may include antibiotics, antifungal medications, or vaginal moisturizer. To keep vaginitis at bay, avoid products like douches, vaginal wipes, or sprays. Don't wear damp underwear or bathing suits. Limit your sexual partners and avoid STIs by asking male sexual partners to wear condoms. Now, here's another interesting article in the Harvard Women's Health Watch of October 2023, and it's entitled, Not Your Grandmother's Breast Cancer Treatment. Recent advances have transformed a one-size-fits-all approach into a personalized treatment arsenal. Some things never change. A breast cancer diagnosis still evokes a storm of anxiety, just as it did decades ago, despite the fact that survival rates have soared. While more than 2 million women worldwide receive a breast cancer diagnosis every year, the average risk of dying in the following 5 years has dropped from 14% to just 5%. Since the 1990s, according to a June 2023 study involving 500,000 women. For many women, breast cancer diagnosis is particularly unsettling because we often don't know why a person developed it, says Dr. Harold Burstein, a medical oncologist at Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. But the good news is outcomes are getting better and better. There's a good reason for this survival swing. While breast cancer was once believed to be a single disease requiring a single treatment approach, scientists can now categorize breast tumors by cell type, opening the door for treatment combinations tailored toward each. Nowadays, surgery is still de rigueur for most types of breast cancer. But once mainstay chemotherapy may be used in smaller amounts or skipped entirely. Newer drugs have enabled doctors to personalize each woman's arsenal of options. These include immunotherapy, which harnesses the power of the immune system to kill cancer cells, and targeted therapies aimed at gene mutations or proteins active in cancer growth. As we recognize these important subsets of breast cancer, we're tailoring a treatment to the individual and the special circumstances of each breast cancer, Dr. Burstein says. There isn't an infinite number of treatments, but the toolbox keeps getting bigger. And why are the treatments improving? Even in the past 10 years, there have been marked shifts in treatment approach, thanks to extensive research that clarifies how genes and cells behave in various cancer subtypes. This, in turn, fueled the development of groundbreaking tests. Some can identify women with BRCA gene mutations that drastically raise their risk of developing breast cancer, while other tests help predict the likelihood a tumor will grow or spread to better pinpoint treatment needs. These efforts have revealed that some types of breast cancer may respond to less intensive chemotherapy. The first kind of breast cancer is ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, which accounts for 3/4 of all cases. And there's been a great treatment overhaul of this type of breast cancer. By the year 2000, we were giving chemo to almost every woman with this type of cancer. We understood it was overkill and most women received very little benefit, but we didn't have a robust tool to distinguish who did and who didn't need chemotherapy. Now we have powerful genomic tools that allow us to say a person might not need chemo as part of their treatment plan. Additionally, a class of medications called CDK4/6 inhibitors, which target proteins that can fuel growth of ER-positive breast cancer, is often added to a person's blend of treatment if her cancer is considered high risk for spread. Then there's HER2-positive breast cancer, a more aggressive subtype that constitutes about 1 in 5 cases and has become more curable thanks to targeted therapies that disrupt the HER2 protein that fuels its growth. The monoclonal antibody trastuzumab, or Herceptin, revolutionized treatment over the past 2 decades, making chemotherapy less necessary, though doctors may combine the two to maximize effectiveness. Then there's triple-negative breast cancer, which is a rapidly growing type that remains a holdout in attempts to reduce chemotherapy. And we're using more treatment because we found more drugs that are effective. We've amped up chemo, started adding immunotherapy, and have some specific therapies for women with hereditary breast cancers as well. And I'll continue this article in the next session. But it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.